From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the form of a political cartoon in France, one that caused outrage. The cartoon came at a time when the press is supposed to be free, but sometimes there are rough consequences for those who seek to use satire to make a point. And if you think we're talking about the Charlie Hebdo murders last week, well, we're going to talk about that. But in this case, our connection goes back to the year 1832. King Louis-Philippe had abolished censorship of the press in France 2 years prior, 1830, right after he took the throne. It was a watershed moment for press freedom, it seemed. But it didn't take long for humorists to test the king's commitment to a free press. Honoré Daumier drew a cartoon that would become famous. It depicted a mammoth, pear-shaped King Louis-Philippe called Gargantua. In the cartoon, the king is eating baskets of money prepared by the peasants of France. It was a cartoon meant to poke fun or shame the king, make a point. And despite the king's claim to support a free press, Daumier and his publisher were indicted for arousing hatred and contempt and for offending the king's person. Daumier went to prison. So satire and political cartooning has a long history, sometimes a history of consequences. This hour we examine the value of satire in cartoons. We ask what makes them effective, what comes next after Charlie Hebdo. My guests for the hour include Elaine Miller, a woman who's collected and studied political cartoons for 3 decades now. Is that right?
Yes.
It's about 3 decades. Yes. Great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Bill Alden's here, a local cartoonist, and I'm holding some of his work, and I wish you could see it, but later today I'm going to post his newest effort on our Twitter page and our social media sites. Bill is a Livingston County native. His work used to appear in the Lake and Valley Clarion back in the day in Livingston County, but a very, very good cartoonist, and nice to see you here, Bill. Thank you for taking the time as well.
Thank you, Evan.
As a cartoonist, Bill, what goes through your mind after you heard about Charlie Hebdo?
Well, you know, what goes through my mind is self-censorship. That's what you start wrestling with. You start wondering, geez, you know, what would I do if someone threatened me for my art? And it's a hard one. I guess you don't know until a cartoon pops into your head that you want to do that you know is going to cause ire in some people's minds. And do you have the courage to go ahead anyway if your conviction says this is what I believe? I don't know. I haven't really been put in that position. Of course, I felt horrified by the idea that anyone would take another life over an illustration, a cartoon that is repulsive to anyone, and so they take up your pen. You take up your pen.
Boy, you're right. It is horrifying. But Bill, that says to me the power of the medium still exists, right?
Yeah, it does. It affects people. I like to use it for humor mostly. I like to make people laugh. So my cartoons don't generally go in the direction that Charlie Hebdo went in. Those were striking at the heart of the beast, and the beast can be nasty in return. I like humor. I like to make people laugh mostly. I'm not afraid of doing something that might step on toes, but I prefer to make people laugh. Humor is the basis of my cartoon.
Elaine, you've studied political cartoons, and City Newspaper ran this nice profile of Elaine just a month ago, less than a month ago, before Charlie Hebdo, in which you talked about the occasional risk, but the value not only of cartooning, but your lament about the fact that there appear to be fewer cartoons these days. What went through your mind when you heard about Charlie Hebdo?
Well, the horrific nature of the incident, as Bill has said, a number of those feelings. The irony, I guess you'd call it, that such a horrific event has triggered a discussion that we would like to have ongoing in a more civilized way, that is freedom of the press. And they say that cartoonists are on the front, on the receiving end of the first strikes at that, some like the proverbial canaries in the coal mines. So all of those thoughts that this was going to trigger an avalanche of commentary from a wide variety of perspectives, as it has, which is interesting to watch, but the sheer sadness of about the incident.
For our listeners, we'd love to hear from you this hour regarding what you think about the work of satirists, and in particular, as Bill Alden says, the work of the Charlie Hebdos of the world that really do intend to strike at the heart of those who would be occasionally offended, willing to offend in some ways. It's 844-295-TALK. I'd love to hear from you. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Now, Elaine Miller has collected and studied political cartoons. Going back to what sparked this interest for you?
Well, I was at a seminar on humor and cross-cultural perspective out at UC Berkeley, and it was the summer of 1984. And there began to be talk of a woman vice presidential candidate, mm-hmm. and then very specific talk about Geraldine Ferraro as the possible candidate. And so my friends in the seminar, we all had to have a project, and my friends began telling me about jokes that they were hearing about cartoons as well. And I was so taken with the cartoons that I decided to make that my project, which is portrayals of Geraldine Ferraro together with Walter Mondale in the political cartoons. And it was quite a window on sexism in the cartoon portrayals.
I was just going to ask that. You found a look into the way, frankly, this country treats women in power, the way women, I think, are unfairly treated. You know, what did you see when it came to Geraldine Ferraro that year and then going forward in cartooning?
Well, what I saw was a lot of humor and a lot of reliance on stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And we know there's like a cornucopia of stereotypes to draw on about many things, but in this case about women. But let me recount a conversation I had with Tom Tolles at the time I was interviewing him for the video about the portrayals of Ferraro. And he said, very interestingly, he said, the cartoonist, speaking for himself, of course, we're looking to do portrayals that do not rely on sexist stereotypes. And that's perhaps the first time, well, in contemporary terms, the first time that we've been confronted with a female in such a position of high political visibility that we're having to deal with this on the spot. And I thought it was a wonderful commentary. So he was giving it serious thought.
She mentioned Tom Tolles, and Bill, you smiled. I wonder, who are the best to you? Tom Tolles, the Tom Tomorrows of the world, who are the best?
I think those are very good. Oliphant, Adams, when it does the Adams family. Any cartoon that makes me laugh, really. I read the cartoon page of the newspaper every day. I have my favorites, just for personal reasons. The drawings sometimes do it. Sometimes it's the message. Doonesbury, you know, is the message. It's hard to categorize as a lot.
In all forms of communication, in media, in journalism, jobs are being cut. I mean, just about all. And so we've seen, Elaine, fewer political cartoonists, and I know Bill can probably speak to that directly, but when you look around the landscape, how different is it now, 2015 versus 1984, when you really took an interest in this?
Well, the number of cartoonists is greatly reduced, and that you can see that happening dramatically over the decades, I guess it would be, for a number of reasons. One is the finances of the newspaper, and another is the rush to technology and the website, with greater production on the website. A couple of things that have contributed. Right now, I think the number may be down to about 80 cartoonists, down from several hundred in the past.
What's the impact of that, Elaine?
Well, some of the cartoonists say, I quote Signe Wilkinson, Philadelphia Daily News, one of the first losses is local, cartooning about local events, because what happens is the papers can rely on a packet that they'll get from a syndicate, and they can pick cartoons out of there. So the likelihood of having cartoons about local events is greatly reduced from when papers had staff cartoonists.
Sure. And I'm looking here at the Lake and Valley Clarion, and the one I'm holding goes back to, this is 2005. It's 10 years ago. Bill Alden was drawing cartoons And the cover story here is about ambulance issues in the town. So they may be parochial issues, but they matter to a lot of the people there. And Bill's got this great drawing of an ambulance with its tongue hanging out, the wheels are flat, and it's being checked, I think, for a fever, a thermometer in its mouth. It's a great, in one illustration, you immediately say, oh, there are problems there on staff. Bill, when you were drawing for the Lake and Valley Clarion, when you're in Livingston County, again, to Elaine's point, it's one thing when you're offered a menu of national drawings and ideas, but don't we need these local voices?
I think we do. Those particular ones, I worked with the editor, and so they were the editor's ideas. Mm-hmm. All I had to do was come up with an illustration that illustrated what they wanted to portray. And often they would send me pictures of local politicians or whatever, and then I would work their faces into the cartoons and do a caricature of them. That's different from what I want to put on paper. I have submitted a number of cartoons to the local Rochester paper and been rejected most of the time. I've had a few printed, but I find editorial boards to be very conservative. They don't want to step on anyone's toes, and so it's very, very difficult to get through cartoons with an edge, I find, with a board of people sitting over you that are protective. They're protective of their advertisers. They're protective of their community. They're protective of offending anyone that might backlash on them.
So, and this is before Charlie Hebdo. I mean,
way before.
Yeah.
Way before, yeah. So that's kind of stifling. I would end up just not sending any more in because I got tired of the restrictions that were put on it. And so, you basically, as a cartoonist, you do them for yourself. You're doing them for yourself. And then if anyone else likes them, that's great. That's great. And that's why Elaine states about the syndicates. That's where you have to go. You get involved with a syndicate. You do the cartoon that you want to do. You give it to the syndicate. And then they try to find a paper. They try to marry it with a paper that is willing or able to or wants to address those issues that you're in.
Well, we're going to get to the phones here, and we're going to start to shift the conversation toward some of the specific Charlie Hebdo drawings. I'm curious to know what our panelists think about what was published and what will be published. We see the headline just out today. The new Charlie Hebdo that will be published, I think, on Wednesday will include images of Mohammed. They're going to try to make a point that they will not back down. And I want to hear more from our listeners. So let's start with Ingrid in Penfield. Go ahead, Ingrid.
Hi, thanks for the show. I've been looking forward to it. Some of the most thought-provoking, moving things I've ever seen in newspapers are cartoons, and I've been following Elaine's work a little bit, and I've tried to educate myself more about political cartoons. And I am wondering what security was in place at Charlie Hebdo. Obviously, it wasn't enough, and whether, as a result of this, security for cartoonists everywhere is going to be beefed up so they can continue to do what they do.
It's a good question, Ingrid. What I know, first of all, offhand, is that in 2011, there was a kind of a firebombing in the offices of Charlie Hebdo, and at least since then, the editor had an armed officer there in the building who happened to be there and was killed last Wednesday. And so the armed protection that they had was certainly not sufficient to repel a very well-trained and organized threat. But Bill, Elena, are you familiar with any other thoughts about security? And Elaine, what about you?
I'm really not. I don't know enough about it, except only what I have read in the papers.
Yeah, and I do suspect we will see, and certainly Charlie Hebdo will be very, very well protected now going forward. But Bill, you hear anything about threats?
You know, I look at it, it's journalism. It's journalism. All journalists have to be concerned. Print journalists, anyone who is going to state how they truly feel and possibly offend someone, you know, the readiness is all. You have to be ready and like I say, when this happened, I went through a series of debates with myself. You know, how far do I want to go? Self-censorship enters into your mind, and then you wrestle with that.
There's a chilling effect potentially.
There is a chilling effect, but only if you let it. Only if you let it.
Yeah. And the Committee to Protect Journalists, an international organization, reports that last year, I think nearly 70 journalists were killed working. And often in war-torn countries, that kind of a thing, sometimes taken hostage, and we've seen some very high-profile, awful tragedies there. But Ingrid, I wish I had a better answer for you other than to say that I agree with Bill in that there will probably be an elevation in protection even beyond Charlie Hebdo you may see in certain other places. But in other ways, the practice of journalism may be under threat in perpetuity, the way that some people feel threatened by the truth, I guess. I hope that answers your question.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure, sure.
I am wondering whether the opposite effect is going to happen. I have seen some news broadcast where one of the TV reporters said that when the Danish cartoon was published, no paper in the United States had what he said had the balls to publish it.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like he was throwing down a gauntlet there. And I am wondering if in the wake of Charlie Hebdo, we're going to actually see more provocative cartooning.
It's a great question, Ingrid. Thank you for the call. And as an example of what Ingrid's talking about, last week after Charlie Hebdo, we saw a lot of organizations sort of wrestling, do we show solidarity and publish some of their covers? And many did.
Even though we don't personally agree with the way Charlie Hebdo approaches this, we don't agree with it. We don't think those images are good or representative of what we feel, but we're going to print them anyway just because you're trying to stop them and it's a freedom of thought.
Yeah, right. I think that's right. And but then you had, for example, CNN had this internal debate. They chose, or their news leaders chose, we're not going to show any images, but they encouraged their staff to talk about what the images looked like, which a lot of people thought was cowardly. So it's a difficult debate. But then again, I think if I'm running CNN, I've got to make a decision about whether we show them. And then I think about what Bill Alden just said here. As a cartoonist, you think about, am I putting myself at risk? Because of when you see Charlie Hebdo, you think about that. Then you think if you're the leader of CNN and you're going to broadcast those images, are you putting your people at risk? So we're all human beings. I want to think that journalistic purity would say CNN's going to say, today, we're going to publish the damn things. I don't care. We're doing it. But then it's a human being who has to think about, what if someone is hurt or killed on my watch because of that? It's not easy,
but
is what I'm saying.
You know, consider that part of political cartooning is journalism, but part of it is also art.
Mm-hmm.
It absolutely is art, fine art. And art always is always in that realm. People are always offended by art, and a lot of artists, that's the point. That is the point. Producing art that offends someone's sensibilities and tries to awaken in them some process of rethinking whatever issue is being illustrated. So it's the cartoonist is in a very difficult position, but speaking as one who draws political cartoons, it's not a long debate with in the cartoonist's mind. I think they quickly come to the realization that I cannot stifle myself. I cannot allow someone else to impinge on what I'm trying to express, what I want to say. And it's as simple as that. I mean, of course, this latest tragedy puts it into starkly real parameters. But no, you think about it for just a second. And of course, I don't want to offend anyone with my drawings. I don't want to do a drawing that is blatantly stereotypical and offensive to a whole, race or a whole religion. But so I will try to handle it in a way that is not, that the idea gets through without unintentionally, without purposely provoking a reaction.
You're saying you can change minds or encourage conversation without being sort of crudely inflammatory.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so before I get back to the phones, because we've got, I'm sure, based on the color board I'm looking at, some very interesting discussion points, let me ask both of you. Bill's point is that after Charlie Hebdo, whether you agreed with those cartoons or not, or whether you would have endorsed them for your own publication, it was helpful for those organizations that at least put them out there to say, we may not like it, but we support free expression, and we're not going to tolerate someone who's trying to silence voices. Therefore, we're going to publish it. CNN said no. Elaine, would you have liked to see more organizations say, whether we agree with Charlie Hebdo or not, today we show the cartoons because we stand in solidarity? Yeah?
Well, I think ideally, yes, you want to go ahead and publish and honor the principle. But there are so many, as you pointed out so eloquently, there are so many considerations that it's very hard to make a judgment about who should have or even what I wish might have happened, because there are all of those considerations as human beings that we need to juggle. But yes, freedom of the press and freedom of expression, yes, to be protected.
Yeah. So, Bill, you would have said it's hard, but we have to do this. This is something that, this is an important moment to show solidarity.
Yeah, I don't even know. It's more of an intrinsic thing than
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
The thinking comes later. It didn't take me long to, when I was shocked, to say, well, it's not going to stop me from drawing what I want to draw. If I want to draw Muhammad, I'll draw Muhammad. You know, it doesn't last very long. You just go on.
Back to the phones we go. My guests are Elaine Miller, who has collected and studied political cartoons for 3 decades, and Bill Alden, a local cartoonist. This is Ken in Pittsford. Go ahead, Ken.
Hey, Evan.
Go ahead, Tim.
Freedom of speech aspect, especially by journalists. I wish our papers were completely uncensored language, whatever. That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is that some of these cartoons were not, and I'm kind of tired of hearing the thought-provoking. Some were, but some were just mean. I mean, I grew up Catholic and kind of fell off that wagon, but I would never argue with someone and make fun of their religion just for the sake of making fun of their religion. I mean, at what point do you say, yeah, this is thought-provoking, and gosh, some of those you look at and you're just saying, how do you as a human being actually print that and think, yeah, this is thought-provoking, and not, you know, think that it's going to be mean and get some sort of reaction. Now, the killings, there's no excuse for that. That's terrible, but, you know, I just hear journalists saying, well, you have to print this, you have to show this, you have to be able to do it. That's great, you have to be able to do it, but it doesn't mean people are going to agree with you, and it doesn't mean people should agree with you just because you might have the opposite opinion from maybe the mainstream. Morality of some sort. I'm not saying it has to be religious morality, but just doing the right thing. Some of the stuff is just downright mean and offensive.
Tim, thank you for the call. And Elaine, as someone who studied these cartoons, do you agree with Tim's point there?
That some are just plain mean?
Yeah, and that what is the, sometimes the point is clear. For example, a Charlie Hebdo cover recently had a member of ISIS sort of blindly swinging a sword and decapitating people, and he was about to decapitate Muhammad without even realizing that that's who he was doing. And the point that cover was making was, this is a group that claims to be representing a faith, and yet they're more likely to kill their own. They're hurting their own faith. And I understood that point very well. In other ways, certain cartoons may be viewed as inflammatory for the sake of being inflammatory. So I think Tim is saying, let's not make heroes out of Charlie Hebdo. What do you think, Elaine?
Well, I've been reading as many columns as I can by non-cartoonist columnist commentators. And there was one especially insightful one that I was really glad to have run across. And the point being made there is that there is freedom, there is legal freedom, and there is social reaction. And you hope for a society that is able to exercise discriminating judgments about what is an appropriate use of humor and what is, quote, too far or too over the edge. And if society reacts to these various sources of humor, which are some of which are extremely confrontational, then there will be a kind of a listing, a hierarchy of the different sources that we believe in to a greater or lesser degree. I know that's idealistic, but that's the kind of society, social reaction that you hope for.
Bill?
Now, I wonder if Tim would apply the same thinking to other art forms, such as music comes to mind. There's a lot of offensive things that are said in music lyrics, in music itself. And but do you stop it?
Yeah, I'm trying to interpret Tim's point to say, my goodness, no one should ever die for something like that. And there's a real problem with that. But at the same time, I think Tim is saying, let's not celebrate Charlie Hebdo as necessarily every single cartoon was heroic and noble. And that may be a fair point.
Yeah. Absolutely it is.
If you're just joining us, Elaine and Bill are helping take us through this conversation. Every single phone line is filled up. This community is buzzing about this issue, and we're trying to understand the value of satire, political cartoons. The news today that Charlie Hebdo will have images of Muhammad in their next issue, and they are not backing down, but certainly you're going to see more security there. We're going to get to your phone calls in just a second. But let me also tell you that I've been kind of going through a list of interesting political cartoons throughout history. And I go back to 1984 at The Nation. There was a debate about whether to publish a Kissinger cartoon. I wonder if our guests are offended by this. And all I will tell our audience is it is easy to find. The notion that the cartoonist wanted to share was that his concern was that Henry Kissinger was putting in the U.S. in a position where the entire world felt like the United States was screwing the world. Well, this cartoon, Elaine, would you have published this cartoon? I don't need to describe it too much more for our listeners. Their imaginations will take them there. Would you have published that, Bill?
Sure. Why not? It shows a caricature of Henry Kissinger, and underneath him is sort of a female figure with a world on it as a head, the globe as its head. They're in bed.
Okay.
He's on top of the other one with an American flag as the blanket. Yeah.
Okay. And you'd say, okay.
I would say, okay, sure.
The Nation magazine had a great debate about that before they decided to print.
The first political cartoon I ever did, and I didn't dig it up to bring in to show you, Evan, was during the Vietnam War, and I had a huge American flag like Patton, like the George Patton movie, which was recently had come out in the background, and in the foreground was the Grim Reaper. And that was the first time I had teachers coming up to me, you know, expressing, their dismay that I would take that position or that, and it was, it was an image that spoke to exactly the way I felt at that moment, at the height of the Vietnam War. Sure, it might offend people that felt differently from me, but should I not draw it? Never occurred to me. Never occurred to me. Mm-hmm. Never occurred to me.
Elaine, the Henry Kissinger cartoon?
Yes,
offensive
well,
to you?
It's a terrific cartoon. Well, let us say it's like a petri dish for feminist critique and analysis. But yes, I would publish it. It's quite a compelling image, and it's consistent with what we recognize.
Callers, we're coming to you next, and all five lines are filled up. 60-second break, and we come back to your phone calls on Connections as we look at the impact of the attacks on Charlie Hebdo, the value of satire and political cartooning going forward with Elaine Miller and Bill Alden in studio. Short break and your calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we're looking at development plans for the Port of Rochester, Shalott, and we'll talk to a group called Shalott Strong. They're saying that they're concerned about some of the plans and some of the turns these plans have taken. What does the city of Rochester say? What's coming to the Port of Rochester? That conversation Tuesday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Rochester Area Vegan Society, presenting a 6-week course for credit in plant-based nutrition for physicians and open to the general public. Classes start Tuesday, January 20th at Unity Hospital Education Center. Register at rochesterveg.org.
Welcome back. Before I jump into the phone lines, let me say that our guests, I'm not even giving them credit for their varied backgrounds. Bill Alden, I knew as a television director at 13 Wham News, and Bill had a little fun with a cartoon of, let's say, a young reporter with male pattern baldness a few years ago. and Bill, I think in this, the reporter is covering a great local event called the Lint Fest. The reporter is saying the excitement is palpable here at the International Lint Festival 2011, maybe perhaps poking fun at the fact that occasionally commercial television news is a little overheated about silly things.
This young reporter was sent out day after day after day after day. Didn't matter what they were sending him out to cover, he had to have something live on TV.
I don't know who you could be talking about, but he does have enormous ears and male pattern baldness.
When he went into journalism, he quite pictured for himself.
Indeed. And there's another cartoon that Bill drew with a patient. It says U.S. Recovery, and it's a patient. It says the patient is stabilized, vital signs are good, and we're hopeful that, wait, what are you doing? The doctor says to an elephant with a GOP button. You're apparently criticizing
pulling
the GOP.
Pulling the plug. He's pulling the life support plug out of the machines that are keeping this patient alive.
So this was a political cartoon that Bill drew, and this one had some resistance?
I submitted that, and it was rejected.
Everywhere you went with this? Rejected?
Yeah.
Okay. People didn't like
it? I didn't go a lot of places. Okay. Let's put it that way.
But local
the editorial board took one look at it and said, not doing it. And why? It definitely takes a side. It picks a side that it is on, and it picks a side that it is not on, and it's political. And they weren't going there.
And so it's your illustration, again, of saying editorial boards can be risk-averse.
Very, very risk-averse, which is very frustrating to an artist. I mean, an artist, I'm not looking to fight with anybody. I'm not looking to argue with anybody and try to, you know, make my point to them. Why should you say this? I put it out there. If they reject it, they reject it.
Elaine Miller, our guest, has not only collected and studied political cartoons for decades, but tell me about your teaching background.
I was on the faculty at the college at Brockport for many years in the Department of Foreign Languages, and I taught Spanish and Spanish Lit and Culture and also Women's Studies. So that'll give you an idea about why I'm interested in analyzing. Right. Well, it did start out with looking at images, portrayals of femaleness and femininity. But I would find in any of my classes, I could use political cartoons to spark discussion. I even found a way to do it in advanced Spanish grammar. So cartoons are wonderful. Sometimes the professors joke about the aura of the overhead, but it's true. The cartoons are wonderful for establishing conversation and debates even.
This is Gail in Rochester. Gail, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm enjoying listening to this. I think, you know, the conversations about things like what he's talking about risk, I forget how.
Risk aversion, yep.
Risk aversion. I mean, that is pretty blatant now in our country. In a way, it's not killing, it's not murdering someone, but it's murdering an idea. And I feel that, even though it's not the same thing, far from it, it is somewhat... even more sneaky in a way, because it is a murder of people's ideas. They don't. If you try to get into conversations with people about anything political, it depends on where you are in the workplace, whatever. People are very afraid to talk about things. So I'll say that, and then also the subject of the murder in France, and also the Vincent Van Gogh's grandson.
Theo Van Gogh, yes, was murdered for a film, yes.
Yeah, okay, so now that's taking the murder of this type of thinking of to a different level. Obviously, now they're actually physically murdering someone for an idea. It's two different, totally different levels, But it's just something to consider. That's, I just wanted to bring that subject up.
Yeah. Gail, thank you for the call. And Bill, again, her point that when we see this risk aversion, the impact is the death of ideas.
Yeah. Well, it's pervasive through all of journalism. You know, people think about their advertisers nowadays. Did Edward R. Murrow really think about his advertisers? No. No, he didn't. And he got into quite a bit of conflict with CBS about that. But to their credit, they said, Walter Cronkite, you know, he's a newsman first. He has integrity to his profession. Then we'll consider, you know, the advertisers or the you know, whoever else, the public. I admire that. I've had discussions with my wife Amy, and she just would say, you know, no journalist can possibly live up to that ideal. You know, the ideal of that they're always going to speak the truth from their heart. There's always going to be some sort of self-censorship. But that's not what they teach you in school, I don't believe. I think they teach you to go for truth, whether it hurts someone or hurts your bottom line or anything else.
Or your own company.
Or your own company, or gets you killed. I mean, that's really what you make that choice. You make that choice. And it's either you do it, you speak the truth, or you don't. And to me, that's too commercial. To try to sit there and think, well, what should I put in this cartoon and what should I not put in this cartoon because, you know, a Ford dealership might not like it or, you know, whatever. No, you can't. How can you do that? You're going to be kowtowing to everybody's whim. Everybody who is offended by whatever is going to have control over you. And you got to fight that. You got to fight it.
This is Fred in Penfield. Go ahead, Fred. Are you there, Fred?
Fred,
go ahead.
Sorry.
Yep.
I just wanted to add something to your conversation briefly. What we're talking about is humor. What we're not talking about is self-censorship. There was no concern over self-censorship in Nazi Germany or in Soviet Russia, at least after Stalin, after Lenin was killed. And we never expected it. There was no censorship in Stars and Stripes when Bill Malden was turning out 200 to 400 cartoons a year. Eisenhower wasn't concerned. What we're talking about is what happened in France. And what happened in France was 3.5 million people got up and they said something. And what it was is, we have in France, and we have in the United States, similar constitutions and similar public rights. And the conversation rightly should be about how do we deny the naysayers who claim that we need more top-level control, maybe the 1%. Maybe the 1% of Americans should have the responsibility for reviewing caustic comments, let alone caustic Doonesbury. Doonesbury is probably as good a continuous source of political commentary as I can think of at this moment. Think about what we have to preserve along with 3.5 million people. Maybe we've got nothing in common with 3.5 million people in French. Just the same constitution and what happened in the 17th century. But we should think about that a lot. Because what America's got is the riches of 5,000 years of self-expression.
Fred, thank you for the call. I'm sort of having a hard... I appreciate the comment there and in some ways, though, there are differences comparing our situation to France. And Jake writes to us, and let me read his comment there, because Jake doesn't agree that there's too much in common. He said, could your guest comment on the irony that this cartoon was done in France, where France doesn't have the freedom of speech that we do? irony there, Elaine?
I'd need to know more, hear more about what the comment is.
About French law, Bill?
Isn't it ironic that in this country we have freedom of speech, which protects hate speech? It to some degree it protects hate speech. The Baptist whatever group that spews those sort of things. We as Americans have institutionalized the idea that they have the right to be repulsive, to be offensive. They have that right. We don't have the right to stop them. And the same thing with Germany and the communists. They did have very, very anti-Semitic cartoons and things like that. But when you look back at them now, when you look at them, they don't hit home. They're not true. They ring wrong. They ring off key, if you will. Whereas a political cartoon that does speak the truth, it has a universal appeal. You the caption can be in 100 different languages or no caption at all. As Elaine said earlier to me, some of the best ones don't have any caption at all. And they speak to everyone and they just ring true. They speak truth. I keep saying that, but it's real.
Well, let me get back to the phones. And this is Bernard in Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, I appreciate Bill's comments about freedom of speech. I mean, 17 people, unfortunately, tragically, died in France. But if you go to our national cemeteries, you'll see hundreds of thousands of men that died to defend freedom of speech. So I appreciate your comments, Bill. But you also made some other comments that I'd be interested in exploring, which is, would the Islamic State have done better if they had become an advertiser of this magazine versus attacking it? How much actual control on speech is being done by advertisement in newspapers? And thanks very much for your comments. Again, I appreciate you, Bill.
Yeah, bye-bye. Bernard, thank you. I'll start with you, Bill. If ISIS or whoever is behind these attacks on Charlie Hebdo chose not to attack with guns but to become paid advertisers trying to control the content,
I think their cartoons would fall flat. I really do. I think anyone whose heart is filled with hate and racism and anti-Semitism or whatever, their cartoons are not going to work. They're just not. I'm going to look at them. You're going to look at them. Elaine's going to look at them. And we're going to go, it's not funny. It doesn't, it might speak to some people in the Middle East, just as the Nazi cartoons spoke to some people at that moment in history.
But part of Bernard's point may be, if they truly wanted to influence behavior, if they wanted a chilling effect, if they wanted to stop the cartoons of Muhammad, etc., you can attack them. And what's going to happen? Well, we found out today, Charlie Hebdo's next issue this week will have images of Muhammad.
Right. The reverse.
They're not going to stop them. They're going to feel sort of re-solidified in their strength. What Bernard may be saying is, the way the world works today is, if you want to influence content, become an advertiser. Do you agree with that?
Become an advertiser.
Well, yeah. It's the same kind of comment that you had about...
Become an advocate.
No, I think...
An advertiser puts a sort of monetary, materialistic...
But I'm saying, look, we advertise in your magazine. We don't want you to publish this cartoon, is what he may be saying. That they're going to influence the news department. The sales department influences.
That's
the
what
department.
They do. That's exactly what's happening now. And as you were saying about the what I consider a mild political comment against the GOP, against the Republican Party, which I disagree with many, many times, and it's rejected. It's rejected. Why is it rejected? Because they don't, in my opinion, they don't want to affect, they don't want to offend Republicans. Or if I did another one that was aimed at Democrats, they wouldn't want to affect Democrats. That's a quagmire that maybe why I'm not making my living on doing this. Maybe cartoonists have to be like artists and do it do it for yourself. Do, you know, if you can,
or write the hook for the song.
I mean,
that's
why
easy?
Is,
you get a mainstream pop hit, then you can go back and do your interesting things
right,
that no one will
exactly.
listen to.
Exactly. Why is capitalism always yeah. the main yeah. drive? The main, oh, you got to make money. You got to make money. Well, you know what? As a cartoonist, no, I don't.
Well, that's a fair point, and I'm glad to see your position on that. Elaine, though, when we hear about risk aversion, again, we've been talking about the fact there are fewer political cartoonists, certainly fewer local political cartoonists. Do you perceive that risk aversion as well?
Well, I've, in the course of doing all the work on cartoons, I've talked with a lot of cartoonists, and it seems to be different. There seem to be different experiences. Some of the editorial boards are very controlling of the nature of the message, and some cartoonists describe having essentially free rein to do as they like. But, you know, I'm thinking about the idea of become an advertiser. Remembering Ms. Magazine, one of the workings of this advertising and freedom of speech, one of the key elements is that if you run an article about that's critical of makeup, let's say, your advertiser, Revlon, or one of the makeup companies, is not going to be happy with that. You lose your advertising revenue. So I think there is it's an intriguing way to, it's an intriguing question to ask
and
what the impact would be.
Absolutely. And to Bill's point that he made so importantly earlier, we need a journalism, we need a press that says, you advertised? Too bad. That has nothing to do with me.
Exactly. This paper makes money. You want your ad in our paper because X number thousands of people read it. That's the end of it. You don't have any control. We are not going to let that affect our mission in any way.
But Elaine's right. I'm not saying every organization in the news is impacted directly, and I'm saying that push and pull is happening, and it's important to recognize it and to talk about it. And state what our expectations are. But Bob and Henrietta wants to talk about freedom of speech. Go ahead, Bob.
Thanks, Evan. As always, a powerful and intriguing conversation. The first point I'd like to just comment on or make a point about is that the American model of media has always been advertising driven, one way or another, historically. Secondly, from a historical perspective, the artistic expression and freedom of expression in this country historically, has been used to demonize groups pretty regularly in the major media. I'm thinking of Thomas Nast and his depiction of the Irish as apes and drunkards and simians because they were a minority group and they were an outsider religion. I think one of the cautions here is to recognize the reality that Muslims, regardless of whether they're Arabs, Indonesian, American, African-Americans, whomever, have been consistently, not necessarily intentionally, marginalized and demonized as a group because of their religion, and in some cases because of their race or ethnicity. And so we have to be careful that cartoonists, like writers or any artist, have intentions, motivations, and I think those consequences of those intentions and motivations sometimes have to be understood in a broader context than just one principle, theoretical freedom of speech or freedom of expression. So just wanted to comment on that and appreciate the dialogue. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob. Elaine, what do you think of that?
Tell me again what exactly the point of the question was.
Well, I think he's part of his point is that not to excuse any killings of Charlie Hebdo, but to say that we may miss the fact that Muslims are often marginalized, lampooned, and again, that doesn't make any of that okay at Charlie Hebdo. To state the obvious, my goodness, I hope no one thinks that. But the experience they go through, I think. We might be oversimplifying.
Some of the conversation has gone in that direction. There's such a wide variety of perspectives being offered in the media now. And some have chosen to say it's not only, in fact, one column says it's not about Islam. It's not about terrorism. It's about colonization. And so there is a legacy of the colonial experience that this particular columnist is commenting on that has left, well, a segment of the population without the power to establish the way life shall be, let's just say. And in French, they call it the pouvoir. That power exists within a certain group, and there are others who are repressed. And that what we're seeing is partially, at least, some dimension of that resistance.
Let me close by asking Bill Alden to describe a cartoon that he drew for us.
I was going to ask you to describe it. You're the wordsmith.
Well, Bill drew this for us, and it's a cartoon following Charlie Hebdo. It's called The Sledgehammer and the Flea.
Yeah.
There's a clown standing in front of a tank, and the clown holding a peace, putting the peace sign up in front of the tank.
With a pencil in one hand.
With a pencil in one hand and a peace sign in the other, yeah.
And he's facing down a huge tank and a regiment of black-hooded, very angry-looking individuals displaying weapons. And the one black-hooded person in the turret is holding up an AK-47, and above them flies my representation of the ISIS flag, which is a black flag with the Arabic writing on it.
And again, if you know Bill Alden, I've met Bill and known Bill over the years. This isn't about a commentary on Islam at all. This is a commentary on the difference in expression between extremists and their view of the threat of satire and humor.
And the ridiculousness of using violent force
to go after essentially a clown, to fight an idea.
Yeah.
An idea, a clownish idea.
Yeah. Satire.
The Sledgehammer and the Flea. And it's a beautiful drawing, Bill. And thanks for bringing it. I'm going to take a picture on my wonderful little iPhone, and we'll post it online if you want to take a look at Bill Alden's work. Bill Alden's a local cartoonist and sharing his perspective. It's nice to see you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
And Elaine Miller, who not only taught for many years, but also collected and studied political cartoons, sharing her perspective. Elaine, thank you for letting me convince you to join this panel as well.
Thank you very much.
God bless you for caring, Elaine.
Absolutely. Thanks to Val. Great job as engineer today. I'm Evan Dawson, and thank you for listening to member-supported public radio.